So good afternoon. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. Welcome to High Notes. This presentation will be broadcast on Aspen Public Radio tomorrow at 2, and also is available on the Aspen Public Radio website at any time. So we're grateful to them for that. And I'm very grateful to two guests today who are each making their Aspen debut. So these are people new to us in the mountains, and we're grateful to have them. Immediately to my left is Joy Vinokur, a wonderful harpsichordist, and then Tamás Palfavi, a brilliant trumpet player. So I thought we would start with each of these artists and just establish a little bit about them and their instruments, even. So Joy Vinokur, I think, born in Chicago.
Yes.
I think it should be on. Yeah.
Can you hear me? Wonderful.
Yeah. Whereas Joy was born in the United States, he had a period of important study in France.
Yes, I lived actually most of my adult years in France and still go back and forth between the States and France.
Mm-hmm. Whereas Tamás is born in Hungary. And his early study was there, but then he came to the U.S. To the College Conservatory at Bard College, which is a wonderful program. Ask me about it later.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, and you appear to be college age, so yes. You've only recently graduated, or
I graduated in 2016, okay. But in Hungary, I spent 2 years at Bard College, and we had this double degree program studying music and German. Uh-huh. And all like philosophics, mathematics, all that kind of things, which was very useful. And back to Hungary in 2016, 3 years ago.
Yeah. Great. So pianists will tell you that every piano is different, and every Steinway is different from every other Steinway, and the German Steinways are totally different from the American Steinways, and of course, Bösendorfer even stranger yet. But pianos are much more the same than harpsichords.
That's very, very true.
Yes.
And, you know, it's something that I always attempt to explain to people that today, if we see a piano, whether it's Bechstein, Bösendorfer, Steinways, Mason, Hamlins, the Americans, we are at least looking at the same type of instruments. These are different iterations of the same instrument. With a harpsichord, there is no fixed point at which a harpsichord is a harpsichord. It's just a strung instrument with keyboard and plectra. So the strings are plucked, not struck. But even, say, at the time of Johann Sebastian Bach, there was a rather great difference between German-made harpsichords and French ones and Flemish ones and Italian ones. We do see certain similarities, but by the time Bach dies, instrument makers were also attempting to expand the sonic possibilities of the instrument, occasionally to the detriment of the harpsichord. And finally, well, in Mozart's youth, the piano gradually began taking over.
And what instrument are you playing?
I'm playing a wonderful instrument, so built rather freely after what I would call a late French copy. So it is something that we accept as a fairly standard concert harpsichord, two keyboards, three sets of strings which sound independently. You would individually need to find me on stage, and I would walk you through the details of the instrument. But we can think of a harpsichord as being a bit more like an organ with registers of strings operating independently, mm-hmm. not like the piano where the triple stringing of your piano sounds together. This instrument was made a few years ago by a Colorado gentleman named Reed Schaefer. Reed very amusingly told me that he was tired of encountering horrible harpsichords that he had to tune and repair and make to operate. So with the help of a few experts, Reed, who is a great, great, great piano technician, decided to build a harpsichord. And I will tell you, he did a very darn good job. It plays like a very good concert harpsichord.
Oh, wonderful.
And sounds like one.
Now, I should have said right at the outset that our theme today is the Bach Brandenburg Concertos, and in two recitals, one this evening at 8:30 in Harris Hall, and one tomorrow, Thursday, at 8 o'clock in Harris Hall, will be presenting all six of the Brandenburg Concertos, and in addition, another concerto by Bach and a concerto by Vivaldi. Tomáš, we have already heard you, so you've actually made your Aspen debut already, because last Friday, Tomáš and Stuart Stevenson played a double concerto. In that performance, as in tomorrow's performance, you're going to be playing the flugelhorn.
Yes, indeed.
And,
my new favorite.
I thought maybe you would, first of all, say, what on earth is a flugelhorn? And then we're going to get into what Bach might have intended in this piece.
Yes, so I'm playing now on the flugelhorn, which is sounds like a French horn, and the ancient of this this instrument is the, let's say, cono da caccia, or the natural horn, and this is all where trumpet started. I'm playing on the flugelhorn because we are still not sure what Bach wanted in the second Brandenburg Concerto. There are evidences that that it meant to be for a horn, because the French horn at that time, you call it French horn in English.
We call it French horn.
Okay, so the French horn in this time was in F key, and the natural trumpets was in C and D, and not before and not after. There is no repertoire for F key for trumpet. Only the second Brandenburg Concerto, which makes us think that maybe he meant it for French horn and not for trumpet, because there was no F trumpet in that time.
Yeah, so the score, which is in Bach's hand, says tromba,
yes.
But as Tomáš says, Bach never wrote a trumpet part in F, and he wrote this part in F. It's also, I think, believed that in Curtin, which was the little town where he was then employed, that the same player played both horn and trumpet.
Yes, so in Curtin, he had a wonderful orchestra, and he didn't have French horn in this orchestra. They always invited outsiders. I believe he had 16 very good musicians, and not even French horn, but he had three trumpets. But none of the trumpets had an F trumpet. Also, it's very likely that it was really, I mean, the piece was really difficult to play in the high octave. Still today, among 100 trumpet players, maybe two can play it or three, and maybe one of them is good. And
I will back that up. I won't name names, but in several performances, I know that I am not going to hear the high Fs at all in the piece, and this is just to be accepted.
Yes, and even the best one from 10 performances, maybe 7 is good.
And but there's a different problem that of balance. If you
yes.
achieve the miracle of having a piccolo trumpet player who is able to play the whole thing, that is all you're going to hear.
I think, you know, this is true. So when Tomáš spoke to me about this, I accepted immediately, of course, but we have now a different octave. So his flugelhorn, which is the most beautiful thing you've ever heard, that I will tell you already, he's playing, of course, one octave lower than the written key. So what was Bach's intention? I don't know precisely. What is sure to me as a musician in the second concerto, where we have the solo trumpet, we have oboe, recorder, already how do you balance trumpet and recorder and violin, it's still really a trumpet concerto. The trumpet stands out, the three others tend to play together more, and this octave differentiation in no way is disturbing musically to me.
I agree on it. When I also played it on natural trumpet and piccolo, some of the concerts were great, some of them are not. And it's really difficult to play in a
subtle
to settle in into this chamber music, because this is chamber music, and once the piccolo is there, it just cannot be soft enough for the rest of the group.
And if we think of this flugelhorn with its softer, more woody, more woodwind sound, it blends beautifully with the instruments.
I believe so, and also you said tromba. It's written on the original manuscript or score. So Bach, he always really precisely said what he wanted to hear. And for instance, he used the word clarino, and he used the word that piccolo violin, right?
Yes, the piccolo violin, which of course we don't have, but
yes. But in the first Brandenburg, there's a piccolo violin. And even though the piccolo violin is in a higher register, he didn't use it. He only used it for make a new color in the chamber music. And this is, for me, another evidence that he didn't want to have a really difficult, the most crazy trumpet part, which is almost unplayable. More, he wanted maybe to have a nice color. Mm-hmm. And tromba means trumpet. And when you play a French horn type instrument with the trumpet mouthpiece, it has a unique, special sound, and it's different than playing with French horn mouthpiece, because just the pipe is different.
Fascinating. So to be a name dropper, when I was in college, I did hear Maurice André.
You're lucky.
And Robert Véron Lacroix was leading from the harpsichord, so that was good. I just wanted to drop in one more thing before we go to the endlessly fascinating subject of the Brandenburgs, which is I noticed on your rep list that Jory plays as many contemporary concertos for harpsichord as he plays Baroque or classical concertos. And Tomáš also has a really brilliant history of working with composers and doing new music. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
This is quite a bit older than Tomáš, but going all the way back to my early days, first piano, then harpsichord, I was very interested in what was being composed at that time. I was sort of the person at school, first as a pianist, then as a harpsichordist, to play every single piece written by every single composer, be it professor or student at the schools I attended, and I've carried that into my career. So for instance, my most recently released recording, which I would beg all of you to go out and hear, as I think it's interesting, for 20th Century Concerti. These are dating back to 1934, which is a concerto by Walter Lee, a British composer who lost his life at the beginning of the Second War. Ned Roram, great American composer who is about 96 years of age. This concerto, which had never been performed, was written in 1946. And so Ned, luckily, has been well and happy to hear my recording of his piece. And Viktor Kalibis, great Czech composer, too little known to the American public. He was the husband of Zuzana Ručičková, famous harpsichordist. If some people might have read the big New York Times article last year when she passed on or seen the documentary. Fascinating musician who survived three concentration camps, then had a major, major performance career, and her husband, Viktor Kalibis, wonderful composer, and finally Michael Nyman, most famous as a film composer and jazz performer. So it's a very fun disc.
Great. And you will be playing a unique concerto next week, which is by Frank Martin, and it's a concerto for harpsichord, piano, and harp.
And double string orchestra. I actually recorded that piece probably before Tomáš was born, with Armin Jordan, speaking of name dropping, great, great Swiss conductor. And on that recording, the harpist, a very fine player, Xavier Demestre, who was the first harp, great soloist of the Vienna Philharmonic. And on next Friday, I'm playing it with the harpist who I adore more than anything, Annelien Lennertz, who is presently the concert, the first harp of the Vienna Philharmonic, and Antonelle, of course, who's very well known to this public.
Yes.
So I'm just thrilled.
And Annelien has recently joined our faculty, we're proud to say. So let's turn to the Brandenburgs. First of all, there are six. Why six? There are six solo cello works, six solo violin works, six English suites, six French suites, six
partitas.
What's the sixth thing?
Six kind of six sonatas for violin and concert harpsichord.
Yeah. So what do you think it is about six?
I don't know. What do you think about this? It seems to be Bach's magic number. In some of the instances, you can certainly draw relations to the keys. I'm finding for myself, the Brandenburg seems to be more based on practicality. So you know, two concerti in F major, then to G major, and two in G major, in fact, the fifth, which is really a harpsichord concerto, and maybe the first, possibly the first harpsichord concerto in existence, G major, and finally we jump to B flat for this very unusual sixth concerto. So I don't know precisely why is six that magic number for Bach.
Okay. I saw in...
Thomas might have it.
It's not a big idea, but I know he was an expert on numbers.
Numerology was a great subject.
I think he had a lot of thinking about these numbers, so I'm sure there must be something. Just nobody asked him because they didn't know.
There are too many coincidences. He chooses his...
Too many with numbers, yes.
Well, I'm going to then tour through a couple of comments. One writer says, there is nothing like any Brandenburg concerto in any other Brandenburg concerto. So...
I mean, I think that's true, and again, there are so many ways of expressing this, but going from the first, which is in its way the most symphonic of these, featuring the horns and solo violin and the oboe trio, the second with the wonderful trumpet solo, the third, which is a phenomenal string, how do we say, a nonet, is there a better word? A group of nine. The fourth violin, virtuoso violin solo, accompanied by two recorders, in this case, a flute. The fifth, which is more or less a harpsichord concerto but with concerted flute and violin. And finally, perhaps the strangest of all, and equally extraordinary, the sixth concerto with no violins. It's two solo violas, originally two solo viola da gambas, here played by, of course, by modern celli, with continuo. So I agree with that. It's very clear that one doesn't resemble another in any way.
And for me, what is fascinating that he made new solo instruments at that time.
Yes.
So that the first one is the first piece for when the horns actually have a big role. They play solo parts. In the second, they have this wonderful, I would say it's more or less a solo trumpet thing. And then you have the solo viola, you have a solo harpsichord, and the solo violins. This fascinates me a lot.
And it is juxtaposed against some type of orchestral force.
Well, another observation which I found in reading about today, and I had never thought of this. So Handel and Bach were born in the same year. They were exact contemporaries. Handel was immensely celebrated and important and famous in his time. Bach was largely in little sort of secondary German towns. But the interesting observation to me is that the greater part of Bach's music is sacred, and yet he is primarily known for instrumental and essentially secular music. And the greater part of Handel's work is secular, but he is hugely known for the sacred works. So it's just a paradox.
Yeah, to some extent, of course that's true. When I think of Handel, as much as I would think of Messiah, I would also, of course, think of the operas. And this may be finally at the origin of why he was so widely known, the opera which attracted the general public, the amount of money he was able to attract to his ventures in London. Even when they failed, they would get a tremendous amount of attention and then finally fizzle out. And secular works from Handel, even although he was a great harpsichordist, the repertoire for harpsichord is of somewhat secondary interest, and I say this lovingly and respectfully as I've recorded the eight famous suites, whereas Bach, I think for many reasons, didn't seek ambitiously outside of his comfortable geographic zone.
But the second concerto, which has Tamás's solo, was chosen, I think it was Carl Sagan who actually made the choice, but it's the piece of music on the Voyager that you know, future aliens will learn about music from. Albert Schweitzer, who's very close to us in Aspen, because his only trip to the U.S. ever was to come to the first festival in Aspen in 1949.
But he wrote a beautiful book on Bach, and he regards the Brandenburgs as sacred music. And he says he takes a metaphysical view and says that they represent the fundamental mystery of all things. So that's nice.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But I think he was writing it during the Curtin time. And there he was working as a chief director, I would say, mm-hmm. in this
Kapellmeister.
Yes, yeah. In orchestra. And he had no role in sacred music that time. And that was the time when he wrote most of his not sacred, you say?
Secular.
Oh, yeah. It's a difficult word. music. So I think in his mind, probably that's what he meant. In his mind, all of his work is secular.
Or maybe all the secular work is sacred, I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so also I think it's worth mentioning that, why do we call them Brandenburg concertos?
They were composed to the intention of the Marquess of Brandenburg. He didn't give them this title. They were concert avec plusieurs instruments. Yeah. So just concerti with several instruments. He wrote a French preface. Oh, am I not? Oh, I beg your pardon. I thought I was being offered something to drink, but that was not the case. I beg your pardon. So Bach had met on a voyage the Marquess of Brandenburg, who expressed his admiration for Bach's performance. We have no idea what transpired during that meeting, but Bach, hoping for a new post, likely put together these six concerti, in some cases from pre-existing elements. The first concerto has all sorts of roots in various cantatas, for instance. Bach put these together with a very florid, somewhat obsequious preface in French to the Marquess of Brandenburg. But again, Bach himself certainly didn't title these pieces. I don't believe they were actually performed in Bach's lifetime. And it was a Bach biographer, I think it's Spitta, yeah, who came up with its name, the Brandenburg Concerti, which is a little sexier than Concert avec plusieurs instruments.
Yeah. So it was 150 years after their composition that they became known as the Brandenburg, yes, Concertos. So, and then, Tomasz, you mentioned that he was living in Curtin, where his position was purely secular. He did not write sacred music during that period. But in fact, some of them are thought to have come from Weimar. Is that right?
Yeah, I've seen references to this. That some pieces were possibly composed in Weimar as early as like 1708, in some cases.
But Bach was very thrifty, and throughout his life, he took the good bits of earlier music and stuck them into later music.
I think they all did, frankly.
Yeah. I think it also is a point, and it goes to playing the trumpet solo on the flugelhorn. My teacher was asked by Rosalind Turek a very pointed question. She called who she took to be the 50 most important living composers and called them up. I happened to be sitting next to him when he got this phone call, so I heard the whole thing. And she said, as a composer, what would you think if in 200 years your music was being played on instruments whose capabilities you can at present not even imagine? And she knew perfectly well that all 50 composers would say some version of, I am perfectly good with that if they understand the music. So.
Yeah, there's truth in this, and obviously from my point of view, going from more standard piano training to the harpsichord, living in Europe, playing with period instruments, in other words, people trying to find the trumpets, the violins, etc., that existed at this time. It's all very interesting. The question could also be rejiggered in the other direction, and I'm thinking of some great conductors of our time, even folks like Simon Rattle, but others who want to make new sound discoveries, and these new sound discoveries are going, backwards, really, trying to discover the sound of these Baroque instruments. to surprise our ear. So the question is a good one from Rosalind Doric, but I think it's a double-edged question.
I also agree on it. I think it's more on the color. If they are just trying to find a nice color, which was probably played back at the time, in Bach's time. And I believe if anything makes my life easier, which means like a modern trumpet, which was discovered in, I think, at the end of the 18th century, at the time of Haydn, yes. Yeah. So, and it made the trumpet player's life easier. So why not play on the modern instrument, which actually can make the same warmth sound?
And only just telling on Tamás, because he was speaking to me right before we came into the room, that he's playing with one of the great, great, great Hungarian conductors, Ivan Fischer, and even in modern orchestral context, Maestro Fischer, when he's doing Baroque works, wants the brass to be on natural trumpets. So even he's looking for the special sound.
Working for the special sound, and also German music on German trumpet, American music on American trumpet, Baroque music on Baroque trumpet. And I like this way of thinking of it.
It's interesting.
Well, I was telling Robert Spano the following story. I had no intention of telling the story in public, but now I will. In the 1960s, Erich Leimsdorf was conductor of the Boston Symphony. And this was before this would even be conceived of, but they were doing Brahms' Second Symphony. And in the week of the concert, he said to his horn players, I would like you to play on natural horns. And Brahms Second opens very famously with a super difficult horn thing. It's risky under any conditions, but as Tamás says, if you have a valved instrument, it's much easier. And so his principal horn said, it is far too risky. I cannot take that risk. And Leinstorff said, but I will take complete responsibility. Anyway, it's a sort of anti-conductor story. Now, so in our performances tonight and tomorrow night, we will have modern instruments, but we will have one on a part. And it is,
No.
Oh, really? We have a large ensemble?
We have multiple players on parts.
Okay.
Okay. Erroneous information. We are not playing one on a part. These works by Bach, of course, can be played one on a part. I think of Fifth Brandenburg, where one can perform this with a solo violin, flute, harpsichord, and then four string players, a first violin, viola, cello, etc. No, we are playing it in a more, I don't want to say modern orchestral setting, because it's could be done generally, but we are not, except for the third concerto and the sixth concerto, these are one on a part by their very definition.
Right.
Otherwise, no.
Okay, but it's not the same as a von Karajan gigantic.
No, neither.
Okay, and you will lead from the keyboard,
yes.
Which is, if Bach had performed them, surely how they would have been done.
Yes, and in this context, I love to have these pieces feel like chamber music. I'm not a terribly autocratic person most of the time, and I want to have input from all of the musicians. I try to amalgamate this into a coherent interpretation, but in many of the cases, I'm not waving my hands at the musicians. In the third concerto, I beg your pardon, which is absolutely a string nonet, a string bit for nine, I have the first violin give the cues. I mean, it's coming from that. It's not interesting that this impetus comes from the conductor. So each concerto has its unique character. Sometimes I'm more present. Other times, the conversation is happening around me.
Okay. Let's turn to the fifth concerto, which is the solo part is harpsichord, violin, and flute. But there's a very famous Cadenza.
Yes.
Even to call it a cadenza is not exactly right, because it is like practically the whole movement.
It's a very funny thing. I'm thinking back to a quite fine old recording, and I think it's Neville Mariner and St. Martin's, very famous soloists throughout the Brandenburgs. You know, Jean-Pierre Rampal is the flutist, and I think Henrik Schiering is on this. And you have to look far and wide to find the name of that damned harpsichord player. And yet, the fifth concerto is unique in the pieces in that it features a solo movement practically for this instrument, for the harpsichord. So a very brilliant developed cadenza, which must last 3.5 to 4 minutes. So quite extraordinary.
Well, and even so, you have three soloists, but to my ear, the flute and the violin not only fade away, they sort of fall away.
Very brilliantly, because they're beautifully written parts, but similar to the fourth concerto, which I see as a violin concerto with very brilliant passages, the two flutes or recorders are soloistic, but in the service of the violin. And so perhaps in the fifth concerto, which is really a harpsichord concerto, the flute and the violin ornament the harpsichord part somehow.
Huh, interesting. Now, one theory about this extreme importance of the harpsichord, and Jory has already said, this is possibly the first ever harpsichord concerto, is that Bach's boss in Curtin had bought a very spectacular new instrument.
By Mietke.
Yeah. And Bach had gone to Berlin to get the instrument. That is where he conceivably met the Marquis of Brandenburg.
This would likely be the case. Mm.
And so he brought back the new harpsichord and thought, I better write something spectacular for it. So yeah. That's one theory. I'm sure you've seen Susan McClary's famous essay, a brilliant musicologist at UCLA. But she believes that it's a sort of crypto-Bolshevik thing. She calls it this musical storming of the Bastille. Or she also, in the same essay, refers to the harpsichordist as hijacking the piece. But she thinks it's a deliberate social commentary by Bach, that the violin and the flute represent the aristocracy or the aristocracy and the church, respectively, and the harpsichord is Bach himself asserting
supremacy.
it's
a very interesting theory. Personally speaking, I don't buy it, but it's very interesting.
Okay, so what do you think happened in that piece?
I think the more probable, to me as a musician, the more probable explanation is the first one. Bach had a new instrument that he wanted to show off, and he also wanted to show off his own keyboard abilities and his legendary improvisatory abilities. So although this cadenza is written, it follows what I would call, an improvisatory way of making music that we see in Bach's keyboard toccatas as well, a little bit free-flowing. So taking material, taking themes, and developing this over a few minutes. But as far as actually hijacking, I don't know. Why isn't the fourth concerto, the violin, hijacking the same? I think it's each, or the trumpet in this. I think it's the joy of showing different musical colors throughout. But that's a very fun way of seeing it, but I just don't know.
Okay, well, we will make our own decision. The fifth is tomorrow. Again,
that is correct.
8 p.m. So, Tomasz, how do you feel? You've said actually a lot about color and about the observation that the second is, in the end, really a trumpet concerto.
So I would love to feel that this is a trumpet concerto because we spoke about harpsichord repertoire earlier, and now I would like to talk about a little bit the trumpet repertoire. We don't have many pieces for trumpet. Bach, he used the trumpet in his works, but not as a solo instrument. So I would love to think that this is a trumpet concerto, but I believe so it was written for the French horn. And it's more like a chamber music between the violin, oboe, flute, and French horn. And the French horn should I don't know, flow in into the chamber music and just be an accompaniment sometimes play out loud. That's my opinion.
The second concerto, of course, features this wonderful quartet of soloists, whether we speak of trumpet or, let's say, just the brass instrument. But very, very clearly, the trumpet has to dominate this. I think it's Bach's intention that there's trumpet. The three other instruments are frequently joking together musically. And a little bit, one possible defense for those who think that it is really a clarino piece, a little bit typical to that, the trumpet, French horn, sits out of the slow movement. And this seems to be typical of all of these sonatas. The trumpet plays only in the quick movements. Mm-hmm. But I do find it to be a trumpet concerto or a flugelhorn concerto or a horn concerto. It's just such a special and wonderful thing. And it tickles the ear incredibly.
Yes, that is certain. So there's a bit of a mystery, and Jory is going to explain how we solve it here. As we said, Bach seems to have written these pieces at different times and for different purposes, or has put them together from different sources. But in order to make a big impression on this very important person in Berlin, the Marquess of Brandenburg, and he wrote them out in his own hand, which is somewhat unusual. So he obviously was taking personal care about it. Also, the huge cadenza, which sounds like an improvisation, he did write out note by note. But in the third concerto, he has a really...
Three violins, three violas, three celli, and continual.
Right, and so a big first movement, a big last movement. Five of the six concertos are in three movements. But for the middle movement...
Two chords.
It's just two chords.
And so the second movement is written, I believe it's what we call a half Phrygian cadence. So in this case, the first and last movement, of course, are in G major. The two chords are an A minor chord in the first position, so with C in the bass, resolving to a B major chord, the third degree of G major. I know historically there are certain people who want to see this as some special semicolon, as it were, between the movements. I don't believe that for a second. There is something there. Either Bach improvised a short piece himself, or the violin, or something was played. I have chosen, and not the first person to choose this movement, beautiful, beautiful, yet short, slow movement of the sonata in G major, BWV 1021, for violin and continuo. The largo movement is, I think, 16, 17 measures, and it ends in the same type of cadence, a half Phrygian cadence. So Blake Puglio and I play this movement, and I start to give looks to the orchestra as we approach the end, and they join us for these written chords of the cadence.
So because one theory is that those chords in Bach's time would have been instantly understood as an invitation to improvise something.
I think that's a real possibility. And I think not only an invitation to improvise something, but an invitation to say this is how your improvisation will end. Yeah.
And was it Benjamin Britten who used that, the G major sonata, as an interpolation, or?
I don't know who first used this. Apparently a frequent enough choice, and it's unusual, frankly, for any piece to end in that sort of cadence. So the movement I've chosen is one of those rare instances that I'm able to use a movement note for note as Bach wrote it, and yet join these chords in this movement without any manipulation or simply forgetting about them and jumping to the third movement.
Okay. Well, you mentioned Blake Puglio, so let's take a moment to talk about some of the other performers that we're using. It's a sort of all-star team, some recent alumni, some faculty. Why don't you lead us through?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many wonderful people. I mean, you're looking at one of the great trumpet players I've ever heard. This young guy, you're going to hear him tomorrow night. Blake Puglio, a brilliant young Canadian virtuoso. We have Chad Hoops, an American fellow who has just returned from study in Germany. Fabiola Kim, who came out of the Colburn School, is teaching there now. We have Angelo and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting names of everybody. We have Angelo. Do you know Angelo's last name?
I don't. Chang Yu?
No. Fantastic. We have Paul Huang, who is soloist in the fourth, and I hope to goodness I'm not forgetting anybody because we're rotating these incredible musicians around. We have wonderful young musicians from the Academy, our cellists, our young folk. We have Elaine Duva, who is an American oboist, a longtime principal of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. And I'm sort of awed to be playing next to Elaine because when I was even younger than this guy, I was accompanying students in her class at Manus College of Music.
Nadine is one of the flutists.
So I'm joined by just an incredible group of people. John Zerber, the hornist. I just don't even know what to say. The playing is so incredible that I'm a little bit breathless every time he plays his solo in the first concerto.
Super. And going back to instruments, in the fourth concerto, which has a solo violin, as Troy has said, it's like a violin concerto in sound, but also two flute parts. And in the original score, Bach says flauti diecki, something like that.
I don't recall the exact term. I mean, they are recorders, very clearly, so end-blown flutes. This would be the case also in the second concerto, I beg your pardon. And then traverso flute, so the precursor of the modern flute appears only in the fifth concerto. And Bach, I think, had some interest in using not only new sounds, but in using certain instruments which were already considered somewhat archaic in his time. Mm-hmm. So recorder was gradually going out of fashion. The viola da gamba, which he uses prominently in the sixth concerto, and which also has solos in, I think, St. Matthew Passion, is absolutely past its glory days. We have modern flutes playing the flute parts because this is typical.
But so he calls them echo flutes in the score, but no one knows what that is.
I know, and so certain performances, I've not been present for this, but Nicholas Harnoncourt, a great conductor, even had them kind of off stage. Again, I'm interested, but I don't believe that's exactly what that is. Are they echo just because they do tend to echo the thematic material that the violin plays? I don't know. But they do tend to play this kind of role. They talk to each other, the two flutes, commenting really on the violin's material.
Do you want to say anything about the other works on these programs? So we have tonight three of the Brandenburgs, and then we have a concerto for three violins by Bach, and then tomorrow we have the other three Brandenburgs and a concerto by Vivaldi.
So very briefly, the concerto for three violins in D major would seem to be a reconstruction. So there are a number of works by Bach for multiple harpsichords with strings. There are three for two harpsichords. There are two for three harpsichords and one concerto for four harpsichords and strings, which I'll get to in 1 second. The concerto for three harpsichords and strings in C major here is reconstructed for three violins. So I'm going to assume there is some reference that there is a lost work in D major. It works marvelously for the violins, of course, and especially with our brilliant players. The Vivaldi concerto for four violins and strings in B minor, very famous. I've played in numerous performances of this work. Bach himself liked it well enough that he arranged it note for note for four harpsichords, just expanding a bit on the textured writing. So there we are.
By the way, later in the season, we have an event in which our faculty member, Ari Vardi, will be organizing some wonderful students or recent students, and we'll be doing a Bach concerto for one keyboard, then a Bach concerto for two keyboards, then for three, and then the one for four. So it'll be a sort of progressive evening.
Yes, gradually adding keyboards or harpsichords, or if you're doing this on piano, you worry less about tuning. Yep. But I think the enchantment is rather less, personally.
Well, it will be piano.
Of course.
In our case. Great. I think we might turn now to the audience and see if you have any questions. If you do, please wait for a microphone because it will help us in the broadcast.
Hi, for Joy.
Hi.
Do you ever use the pedal keyboard for a harpsichord?
So when you speak of pedal harpsichord, you're speaking like basically an organ, but harpsichord.
But
so
I think Bach wrote for a 16-foot, which he would do.
A question which requires maybe more than we can do here. It's debatable that Bach at home likely even composed, say, the famous trio sonatas for organ. He was likely playing it on a pedal harpsichord. I'm not much of an organist at all, so that's already an answer to your question. But for friends of mine who are very accomplished at both, there is a general point of view that these big tubby, you know, the pedal instrument, which can have itself up to four sets of strings, the 16 foot, 2/8, and the 4 foot, first of all, a nightmare to tune, and they just don't sound. It doesn't project. So Bach was not dragging around such an instrument. This would have been in his home. To the best of my knowledge, there is not one single example of the pedal itself which survives. We know that they existed. This is beyond any doubt. But the fragility and heaviness of the thing is somewhat of a clue to us that I think this was a practice instrument because you couldn't hire some kid to, you know, pump the organ blowers all day long.
Would you, and we'll come to another question in just a moment, explain to us why you refer to one set of strings as 16 foot and one is 8 foot and one is 4 foot?
I'm not the finest musicologist among us, but these are terms of organology. So we're describing pitch values. So if I need to explain that to anybody in the orchestra, I could say that the violins and flutes and trumpet are 8 foot. And this is based on, if I'm not mistaken, the standard length of the pipe of middle C, 8 foot stop. When I say 4 foot in an orchestra, this will be one octave higher, so dividing the pipe length or string length, piccolo principally, 16 foot, double bass, contrabassoon. So if we're looking at an organ, for instance, where these terms are utterly essential to know, a big church organ might even have some 32 foot stops, so notes sounding 2 octaves below the written pitch and making your stomach rumble when they play.
Great, thank you. Here.
On the second concerto, currently, say, either in the US or in Europe, how frequently is a French horn used versus the flugelhorn?
The question is what is the standard practice, both comparing the US to maybe Europe, in terms of which instrument you use?
So I personally, I never heard it on the French horn.
No.
Never
this
in my life.
This is the first for me.
And this is the first for me too. I am doing it because I believe this is true. And this way I would like to give a new color for this second concerto and give a new meaning for it. And I hope that it will be really welcomed and I will have a chance to play it 100 times more. I know that the first guy who did it on the Corno da Caccia was Ludwig Güttler, who based in Leipzig, and he is a big expert on Baroque music. And he did the research, and that was his idea at first, and who also recorded it on the Corno da Caccia, which only means French horn without...
Yes, a Baroque version of the French
Baroque
horn
version
without valves.
Yes, without valves, and he made a new instrument himself with valves, and he played it with a trumpet mouthpiece, and it was about, 30, 40 years ago. And I never had an example when I heard it alive playing on that instrument.
And I would just say, not even as a conductor of these programs, just as a musician, also enjoying hearing this music, not just playing it, I think that if Tamás wasn't himself, as a performer, enchanted with the sound, research or no research, I think he would put it away. It is a beautiful effect. And it's new to us as well. So, I mean, we will see whether you'll play it 100 more times this way, but it's gorgeous.
It's a surprise.
And the music comes to life through this also in a different way.
I believe so. Yeah.
But you are playing a trumpet mouthpiece.
I use a flugelhorn, which is also a French horn type instrument. And for the flugelhorn to make a better sound, I also use a French horn type mouthpiece. Oh. And this way, the air goes into it more fluently, and the sound becomes warmer and darker. And I think it really fits in.
I wish Thomas had brought the instrument just to show you, but the flugelhorn itself, and I mean, for those of us of any certain age, think back to Chuck Mangione, who had these hits on American radio before you existed, my dear Tomas.
Feels
so good. The flugelhorn has this wonderfully mellow trumpet sound, and Tomas, with his virtuosity and with a French horn mouthpiece, it sounds like a very agile French horn, and it's a slightly rounder-looking trumpet.
And it's very often played in jazz.
Yeah, Chuck Mangione was a kind of pop jazz.
Okay.
And had top 40 hits. And
yes, for me, it's Miles Davis.
I'll find you one later. I'll send you a YouTube video.
Well, Wagner famously calls for F trumpet in Parsifal, which is a very different color of sound. So.
F trumpet?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, in Parsifal, yeah.
Well, explain to us the difference between a cylindrical and a conical mouthpiece.
Well, the cylindrical is when the pipe is not, how you say it, it's...
Straight. Not conic.
The bore. I'm sorry, it's the language. So when the bore is not going out like a bell, then we start talking about cylindric. And the trumpet is a cylindric instrument. And the French horn, the bore is always going wider and wider, and that's the conic instrument. And it has a difference in sound. The cylindric instrument is more brighter. It's better for fanfares and chorus. And the conic instruments like trombone, tuba, French horn, flugelhorn, and all the horns, there are many. And I would say if it's understandable, that's the difference.
Over here.
I have a question about harpsichord technique. As I understand it, you punch the keys?
No, goodness. We eliminate that word from our vocabulary immediately. A finely regulated harpsichord. Let me try to couch my phrase. I think as inventions and patents have developed, because we must remember, as pianos gradually came into existence, the concept of patented works was very much the idea. The harpsichord has no real escapement. So when I depress a key, I'm making contact with a jack, which is a kind of a plank of wood. In that jack is a movable tongue, which contains a plectra, which today is usually a synthetic or plastic type derivative, but can be made with various quill. So as I'm depressing the note, again, on a nicely regulated instrument, small or large, I can feel, as my finger depresses a key, I can feel the string begin to bend. And this is something at the piano, even the greatest of pianists, they will have to explain to you that in somewhere around, I guess, 1840-ish, Erard, a French company, developed what's called the double escapement. So you would never contact the string as a pianist. I'm sure every child who's had a piano in their home has done the little experiment where you push down that key as slowly as you can, and what happens? Nothing at all, because before the hammer can contact the string, it just falls away. And thus, a pianist can extremely rapidly play repeated notes. The hammer doesn't need to fall all the way back before striking, before being thrown at the string. The harpsichord, I must go all the way through the motion of depressing that key. The quill plucks the string. The little tongue allows it to fall back without restriking. And so if I'm playing a beautiful instrument, there is no punching involved at all. I'm very much on the surface of the keys. Finger weight itself is generally sufficient to depress the keys. I mean, we could talk about technique for a few years, but it's far less physically engaged than most piano playing. So going from Bach to Rachmaninoff, a different story. Does that answer your question in any way, even though I cut you off before you could really ask it?
Great. Well, if there are not further questions, I will say thank you very much to Joy Vinokur and Tamás Favi.
Thank you.
And concerts are at 8:30 tonight and at 8 o'clock tomorrow.